It seems that Jnana Prabha had been engaged in fighting a certain warlike tribe on the borders of Western Tibet. And in the course of the fighting, he, Jnana Prabha, was captured. And it seems that his captors couldn't have been very sympathetic to Buddhism, because they gave him a choice. They said, look, we're prepared to release you, we're prepared to set you free, but on one condition: you must renounce your refuge in the Three Jewels. So for Jnana Prabha, as a devout Buddhist, that was a quite impossible condition, so he refused. So his captors then set another condition. They said, all right, you won't renounce your commitment to the Three Jewels, but if your subjects can collect, if they can produce, if they can give us gold equivalent to your weight, then we shall release you. So word was conveyed to Jnana Prabha's nephew, and the nephew spent a number of years collecting gold from all over the country, all over Western Tibet, and he collected a truly enormous amount. But even after collecting and collecting all those years, he still hadn't collected quite enough. He'd collected enough to ransom the king's body, but not enough to ransom also his head. So when Jnana Prabha heard this, well, by the time he heard it, he was quite old. So he told his nephew, or sent a message to his nephew, not to bother to collect any more gold. In any case, his subjects had been sufficiently oppressed in having to raise all that gold to ransom him. He said, let me die in captivity. I'm old. My time is nearly finished anyway. Use the gold to invite Atisha to Tibet. In this way, he said, I, though a captive, will be of some service to the Dharma before I die. So this was the gold that was presented to Atisha. And Atisha was deeply moved by the story of how the gold had come to be collected. He was moved by Jnana Prabha's deep devotion to the Dharma. He was moved by his spirit of self-sacrifice. So Atisha felt that he had to take the invitation to visit Tibet very seriously. These Tibetans seemed very sincere people, really committed to the Dharma, and they really seemed desirous of further, truer Buddhist teaching. So what did Atisha do? What did he do? It seems he didn't consult the other monks. He didn't ask them what they thought, whether they thought he should go or not go. He didn't even think about the matter in the ordinary sense. So what did he do? We are told that he consulted the goddess Tara. Consulted the goddess Tara. But why Tara? Why not some other bodhisattva? It seems that Atisha had been particularly devoted to the goddess, or rather I should say the female bodhisattva, Tara, since his childhood even. And he regarded her as being his yidam, his ishta devata, or tutelary divinity. So at this crisis, this turning point in his life, in his whole career, he consulted her. We don't quite know exactly how he did this. We don't quite know exactly how he, so to speak, established communication with Tara. There's more than one version of this important episode. But it seems that he had a vision of Tara. And it seems that Tara spoke to him as though he heard words, or perhaps thought he heard words, or words were impressed upon his heart. And Tara said, accept the invitation. Go to Tibet. Go to Tibet. But that was not all she said. She also said, if you go to Tibet, your life will be shortened by 20 years. So Atisha accepted the invitation. After all, he took the Bodhisattva ideal and the bodhicitta seriously. He decided to go to Tibet. He couldn't leave at once. He had to hand over his responsibilities. He had to get the permission of the head of the monastery, but eventually he succeeded in doing so. And he left Vikramashila for Western Tibet in 1040. And he was then 58 years of age, not a young man at all, you can see. But before we accompany him on his journey, I want to look at just a few points. First of all, there's this question of his consulting Tara. What does it mean to consult her, or for the matter of that, any other bodhisattva? Who or what is Tara? Tara, like the other archetypal bodhisattvas, as we sometimes call them, is a particular manifestation of the Dharmakaya. A manifestation of the Dharmakaya in an ideal human form. In this case, of course, a female form. So that when we are in contact with Tara, we're in contact with the Dharmakaya. We're in contact with the transcendental. And this contact may take the form of a vision, as it did in the case of Atisha, or it may take other forms. Whatever form it takes, that contact affects us deeply. It may even transform us. After all, contact of that kind amounts to an insight experience. And that experience, that insight experience, may throw light on our existing condition. It may show us what we have to do next. But of course, we do have to be careful. It's easy, of course, to mistake our own whims and fancies, our own subjective imaginations, for the voice of Tara. In Atisha's case, there was no such danger, so he could go ahead and do what Tara advised him to do. But in our case, of course, there is a danger. So we, even if we do believe that we've heard the voice of Tara, so to speak, we would be well advised to consult our spiritual friends and ask for their advice, their opinion. In the very broadest sense, in the very broadest terms, consulting Tara or any other archetypal bodhisattva means acting in accordance with our awareness of what is highest and best in us, the highest and best that is also beyond us. Well, that is just what Atisha did. he decided to go to Tibet, even though going there would shorten his life by 20 years. Like Jnana Prabha, he was prepared to sacrifice his life, or a portion of his life, but a substantial portion, for the sake of the Dharma. And after all, that is the great test. That's the great test. Are we willing to die for the Dharma? Are we willing to die for the three jewels? In this country, we have it very easy. We have no difficulty practicing the Dharma if we want to. Here, Buddhism is not persecuted. It's not discriminated against. But if it was ever persecuted, if it was discriminated against, how many of us, I wonder, would pass that test? I don't know. It's a question that at any rate we at least have to ask ourselves. But one thing I do know, you will be able to die for the Dharma only if you have lived for the Dharma. Fortunately for us, there are still people, even in this 20th century, towards the end of this 20th century, who live for the Dharma. Just a few days ago, I was reminiscing to a few friends about two Indian order members who lived for the Dharma. Their names will be familiar to some of you, perhaps to many of you, Shakyananda and Sangasena. They lived for the Dharma and they died for the Dharma. They were both old men. They were old men even when I ordained them quite a few years ago. And they both suffered from various ailments, especially Shakyananda. He was just a mass of ailments. But that didn't stop them. Year after year, they went from village to village and town to town, giving talks on the Dharma, encouraging people to practice the Dharma. Sangasena, who was a little quiet man, operated in the northern part of Maharashtra, and he was known as the Lion of the North. And Shakyananda, who was a very fat, very jolly man, I used to call him the Buddhist Falstaff, except that he didn't have any of Falstaff's weaknesses, he operated in the southern part and was known as the Lion of the South. And between them, in the course of, I forget exactly how many years, perhaps 5, 6, 7, between them, they must have covered easily 1,000 villages and towns, bringing the Dharma to each and every one of them. And they both died in harness. One might say they both sacrificed their lives for the sake of the Dharma. If they'd not worked so hard and so happily. It wasn't a question that they were sort of getting burned out or anything like that. They loved their work. They were happy, joyful, despite their ailments. And they communicated that joy in the Dharma to other people, to thousands of other people. If they'd not worked so hard in that way, well, they may well have lived a few more years. They weren't great scholars. In fact, they weren't scholars at all. But they were living embodiments of compassion and energy. And they were, in my opinion, worthy successors in spirit of Jnana Prabha and Atisha, and examples to us all. And I would like them not to be forgotten. I would like them to be remembered. And that's why I'm mentioning them at this point.